And welcome back to the Yale Forum on Religion and Ecology podcast. I'm Sam Mickey, and this week I'm joined again by Kimberly Carfor, except unlike the last episode, we won't be hearing very much from Kim. So, Kim, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here again. Although I think I'm taking kind of like, we're switching roles. I think I will be the semi-host for the day.
Yeah, because for anybody who missed the previous episode, we were talking about the American Academy of Religion Conference that happened in Denver in November 2022. And, you know, you and Joe Wieb have been co-chairing the Religion Ecology Unit for the AAR. And so I had you on to give kind of a review of what happened at the conference and a little preview about what you're going to be up to in 2023. And then along the way, you mentioned that I had a paper that I was going to give at the November conference in Denver and wasn't able to make it. So you wanted to hear what I was going to talk about.
Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing to note is that one of your most requested, your biggest requests from your audience is they want to hear more about you. And so this is an opportunity for people to hear about your work and what you've been working on.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, that's been a consistent thing. I'm always looking for feedback because I'm no podcasting expert. So always looking for feedback from people, how to, you know, make it better or change things, how to cater to what the audience is interested in. And one of the things I've often heard is they're like, well, say more about your work. And personally, I don't know, I'm very shy. I don't know. And so I'm not good at self-promotion, but I also just like promoting other people and learning about other people's perspectives. And so don't often share my own. So thanks for this invitation to go ahead and to talk about what I was going to present, it was something for the contemplative studies unit. There's so many units for anybody who's paying attention to this, who doesn't know about the American Academy of Religion. You know, it's a very large, it's the biggest religious studies organization in the country. And there's a lot of different units that pay attention to different things. Like there's a unit just about like Kierkegaard. There's, you know, a unit about religion ecology. There's units about all kinds of stuff, dozens upon dozens of different groups that focus on different areas within the religious studies or theology, religious studies, biblical studies. It's, you know, it's very broad. Mm-hmm. So I was going to present for contemplative studies, and their call was about basically how contemplative studies relate to post-humanism. And that's something I've done a lot of research in. So I submitted something, they accepted it, and regrettably, I wasn't able to make it and actually participate in that panel. And I haven't heard from my fellow panelists, so I'm not sure what happened. I need to get in touch with them. Like, what did I miss?
A lot.
I think I missed a lot. Yeah, so it was really unfortunate. But that happens. Sometimes life happens, and conferences have to go on the back burner. So in any case, yeah, happy to talk a little bit about it and share it with you and just see what you think. The title for the paper was Contemplative Post-Human Design, because again, it was the Contemplative Studies Unit looking at post-humanism, and I want to look at how that related to design studies or design thinking. And I'll tell you, you know, again, I don't always like really sharing a lot about my own work because I always feel like it's not about me, it's about the broader community, community of scholars and researchers, the Living Earth community. It's not about me. And so even for this paper, it really wasn't about me. It was about this philosopher, Peter Sloterdijk, and who I've been very enamored with for many years now. He's just one of these great kind of German philosophers. They can be very bombastic and controversial and very erudite, encyclopedic, you know, writing thousands of pages. And so that's definitely Sloterdijk's work. And I'll make sure to mention him in the notes for this episode. Because even the name might be hard to spell. It's Sloterdijk, Sloterdijk. And Dutch born, if you're wondering, like, why that name? It's a Dutch name. He's a German philosopher. But he's one of the people who really got me thinking about design. But also very interesting stuff on contemplative work and post-humanism and all the post things. Post-modernism, post-secularism. There's all these post-discourses these days. So that was kind of it in a nutshell. I was just going to talk about, you know, what would Sloterdijk say if he was here? Something kind of along those lines. But for now, I don't know, to give you a sense of what I was going to talk about, I guess I'll just describe the terms.
You know, that's kind of where I was going to start. Because even something like post-humanism, like, what does that even mean? So yeah, let's start with the terms. That sounds good.
Yeah, and post-humanism might be the best one to start with. I think that might be the most contested and confusing of those terms. Yeah. And largely because the people who use it in different ways. And when you say post-human, post, you know, just meaning after, right? And you go, sure, after what exactly? And for some people, it's just after the humanism of modernity. You know, there was a kind of Renaissance humanism. The Vitruvian Man of Da Vinci is a good example, this kind of focus on the human, the potential of the human at the center of this kind of image. And that kind of humanism was complicit in the rise of colonialism, capitalism, industrial economic growth, you know. And so people are like, we need to get past that human. We need to return to a more original human. But then some people are like, no, even the more original human, still a problem. So when some people use the term post-humanism, they're trying to get beyond the humanism of like what Karl Jaspers called the Axial Age, right? The kind of time of the Buddha, Socrates, Confucius. And there's a kind of humanism there as well. Very different than modern humanism, which was very often secular and very anthropocentric. The older humanism really lifted up the human, but saw the human as kind of fitting within a sacred order of the cosmos, you know? And so like the Buddha, obviously he's a human and is really the center of that religion. And yet there's so much attention to other dimensions of the cosmos, animals, hungry ghosts, hell realms, God realms, you know, so many other things. But some of the post-humanists are like, yeah, but even then the human was too focused on itself and too isolated from the rest of the world. We need to get past that. Other people take it back even further. And they're like, honestly, that human was only a new addition on Neolithic humanism. And so, you know, if the Buddha and Socrates were talking 2,500 years ago, the agricultural revolution, the Neolithic revolution, we're talking more like 5,000 to 10,000 years ago, depending upon the region that you're in. And so they want to push it back. And they're like, we need to get past the Neolithic. That's when we invented agriculture, when we invented writing, when we saw the widespread emergence of patriarchy and all kinds of forms of social stratification. So we need to get past that and return to something more like our Paleolithic roots, you know, return to a little bit more of the wild, nomadic, hunter-gatherer kind of lifestyle when we were really intimately connected to our environment. And, you know, it's kind of the thing, right, that once literacy was invented, humans became a little disconnected.
Right.
That's a like Neolithic
David
thing.
Abram.
David Abram, Walter Ong. Yeah, some of these folks who have really paid attention to the gap between orality and literacy. So some post-humanists, they're not saying we need to get rid of literacy, but we need to get rid of the human that was constructed by that and tried to recover something closer to orality. And we could do that with new media, like podcasts or TikTok or who knows what. But we need to, you know, shift away from that Neolithic humanism. So modern humanism, Axial Age humanism, Neolithic. Yeah, it's just the word means almost anything.
I mean, yes and no. What I'm seeing, because I'm a very symbolic thinker. So as you're talking, I'm seeing that there's like this bracketing that post, because when you say the word post-humanism, I'm thinking, oh, what comes after the human, whether that's like artificial intelligence or, you know, living on Mars or whatever. So that's what that's like what intuitively I think of when I think of post-humanism. But what you're saying is that there's like a bracketing that you're actually thinking, you're imagining what the future human will be by returning to previous forms of the human. Is that kind of what it is?
Yeah. And yeah, in a lot of ways, or not necessarily returning to, but recovering something from them.
Okay.
Because obviously we can't go backwards. And so a lot of post-humanists who might be very against axial age humanism or Neolithic humanism, that doesn't mean they're against electricity, but it does mean that they want to situate that in something closer to the small scale place-based societies that humans used to live in. But there are some who are straight up trying to get past the very limitations of the human species as such, where they're not talking about the last 500 years, 5,000 years. They're talking about the last couple hundred thousand years. They're talking about getting past Homo sapiens. Those post-humanists are really better described as transhumanists. And transhumanism is really a movement that's trying to overcome the limits of being Homo sapiens. And that includes things like limitations like sickness and aging and death, or our inhabitation of Earth. So things like colonizing Mars. And so, yeah, transhumanism can be seen as like a type of post-humanism that really does want to transcend the human condition entirely. And so things like putting microchips in your brain that enhance your brain's activity and things like that, like Elon Musk's Neuralink company is a good example. Okay. So yeah, you have people, and obviously with Musk, you also have the colonization of Mars and things like that are a big part of his idea. So that's a good example of transhumanism. So some people are looking to overcome the whole species. And I'll tell you, you know, in this paper, my point wasn't to sort out all the varieties of post-humanism to say which one's good. I think they're all kind of a problem, because post is just a bad way to refer to anything. All you're saying is I'm after what came before me. So it's not very articulate in terms of what it's proposing. It says a lot about what it's against, but doesn't say what it's for. So very similar to the problem with terms like postmodernism, post-structuralism, post-anything. All these postal theoretical movements are kind of complicated. I follow Donna Haraway in saying I'm with these movements in a certain respect, but I also don't want to stay there. So when I say I'm with the post-humanism, I say I'm with post. That means compost, right? Compost. So I'm, you know, I'm with post-humanism, but that's kind of, that's not the point. The point is really to think about like what's emerging and not worry too much about what we're against. I mean, similar to post-colonialism, people often refer to everything after World War II as a post-colonial era, right? Like a lot of empires kind of gave back their colonies, you know, like the British Empire withdraws from India, lets India have independence. We say post-colonial. Okay. And of course, that didn't mean colonialism ended.
Right.
It just meant it changed dynamics radically. And so it became this kind of corporate globalization. And that often meant corporate colonialism. Corporations started coming in instead of governments coming in to control you. So a little different, but still very colonial. So I feel the same way with post-humanism. It doesn't mean that the human is over, but it does mean we can reflect on what it's done.
Okay.
And the human has done so much. I mean, people say we're in the time of the Anthropocene. Humans are impacting the planet at a planetary scale. We're changing our global water systems. We're changing the atmosphere, right? We're changing biodiversity. We're in a mass extinction event. And so the human has thoroughly worked over the globe. So it doesn't necessarily mean the human is over, even if we want it to be, but it does mean that there's a lot of questions. And we can ask the questions along each of the posts in post-humanism. What happened with modern humanism? What happened with axial age humanism? What happened with the Neolithic? What happened with the emergence of Homo sapiens as a species? So to me, post-humanism just marks those as a question.
Okay.
That we need to rethink who we are in light of our whole species history, in light of some of the, you know, big kind of events in our emergence from the Paleolithic to the Neolithic, to from the Neolithic to the Axial Age, from the Axial Age to modernity, from the modernity to now. Okay. We need to look at kind of each of those and rethink who we are and what we're doing here. And to my mind, one of the most important things about posthumanism is it's just saying, whatever we're doing here, we're not alone. We need to think about our ecological embeddedness.
Okay, so we're not alone in terms of our ecological niches or non-human kin.
Yeah, or okay. In terms of David Abram, right, the more than human world.
Yeah.
And we need to start accounting for that. And it, important to note, more than human would include things like angels and gods and goddesses. It doesn't just include stones and rivers and mountains and eagles and ospreys.
Is that
and
David Abram? Bears.
Well, I mean, more than human is his term for sure. And but does plenty he of other explicitly? People have. I don't know, actually. That's a really good question. I'm guessing that the way he writes about shamanic spirits and stuff like that, that's included in his idea of the more than human world. But I think more specifically, I'm thinking of Simone Kotva, who's a friend of the podcast. She's been on, and that was kind of one of her points. More than human world has got to include God.
Oh.
Or gods, and if it's more than human, it's more than human. It doesn't just mean materially more than human.
Right.
It works on multiple levels. And so to me, that's all post-human is saying. The post-human is when we kind of put a marker on the human and say, let's think about this a little more deeply. Who are we and who are we with? So that's the post-human. And to me, this is a contemplative issue and a design issue, because in both cases, contemplative practice, you know, meditation, mindfulness, etc., they're often trying to get the human outside of the human. You know, you're trying to contact divinity, or contemplative practices like the desert fathers and mothers. They're connecting with the desert around them and connecting with God. And so it's very much a contemplative problem to think beyond the human. Requires some kind of practices where you can get outside of your human sphere or kind of welcome in something that's beyond the human. And then the design part is that apparently humans make themselves. You know, we evolved in Africa, you know, 200,000 or 300,000 years ago, and then we redesigned ourselves in the Neolithic. And then we redesigned ourselves after the advent of literacy with religions like Buddhism and Confucianism, traditions like, you know, philosophy coming out of ancient Athens. These are all different systems where we rethought who we were and redesigned what we were. And contemplative practice does that. It's a design practice. You're basically forming your subjectivity. So think of fasting as a good example of a kind of contemplative practice. That changes your experience of the world. That changes who you are, changes who you think you are, how you feel about yourself, how you act. And so humans are a design project. You know, again, a lot of this is referring to Peter Sloterdijk's work. And there's a kind of riff on his thinking that a few people have mentioned. Bruno Latour cites this a lot. And it's that human existence is a design project. They kind of play on Heidegger, you know, Martin Heidegger, great German philosopher and, you know, Nazi, terrible mess of German philosophy. And yet he had this nice idea that humans are the there of being. So Dasein is the term. Dasein just means existence in German, but Heidegger used it to refer to human existence in particular. So humans are Dasein.
Like the there, like T-H-E-R-E.
Yeah.
Okay.
Da means there and Sein means being. So Dasein means being there.
Okay.
So like being here, being there. And so we're the there, this kind of openness, we're open to being. But that openness means we form ourselves. We have to decide who we are.
Okay.
We're a design project. So Dasein is design.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's the pun. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Hank Osterling is the guy who came up with that. Latour, I think, is the guy who really popularized that. Latour loves Sloterdijk.
Huh.
Latour's work really lifted up Sloterdijk as the first philosopher of the Anthropocene, which says a lot, because I think a lot of people would credit Bruno Latour with being one of the first philosophers to address the Anthropocene. And you ask Latour, he says, Sloterdijk.
Okay.
He was the guy who really first thought about what it means to be human.
Okay.
In a time when the human has become a planetary presence.
Okay.
So that's a little bit of the contemplative side of it is, you know, contemplative practices are the practices whereby Dasein redesigns itself.
Neat.
It's, and you know, it's about opening onto the more than human, because we're always redesigning ourselves in relationship to our environments. Again, the desert fathers and mothers are a good example. They're redesigning mm-hmm. themselves in relationship to the desert, you know, this early Christian community. So I also have to really give a big nod to Douglas Christie's work, The Blue Sapphire of the Mind, you know, Notes Toward a Contemplative Ecology. He was also one of those people who saw that for humans to reconnect to the more than human world, this is a problem of contemplative practice. You can't do it just by thinking your way out of the human. Mm. You know, you can't just write a book, this is we're beyond the human. We need to do training exercises that actually divest us of a certain perspective of the world and learn to inhabit a bigger perspective.
Okay. You
know, learn to connect with something bigger than yourself. You know, pretty simple. Learn to not be anthropocentric. But you have to practice that. You can't just write it on paper and it happens. You have to do the work. You have to do whether meditation, you know, mindfulness, contemplation, you know, those words can all be kind of grouped together. But that's the idea. So that's why it's contemplative post-human.
Okay.
Like to really do the work of post-humanism is not just theoretical work in the narrow sense of like arguments, texts, interpretations. We have to experiment on ourselves.
Yeah.
We have to train. And by training, we can kind of become this something more. So that explains enough. And again, Sloterdijk writes a lot about this. He's a big advocate for recovering contemplative practices.
Okay. This is really great because whenever I see the word contemplative, I think of, you know, cultivating the mind, you know, sitting in stillness, whether that's prayer, whether that's, you know, in a church or a mosque or a temple or outside. But very much when I think of contemplative, I just think of sitting in stillness. But for you, it's about, what I'm hearing, I have a bunch of notes down. What I'm hearing is Gary Snyder's Practice of the Wild, right? That this practice by practicing, it has this kind of like mutually enhancing or mutually reciprocal feedback loop, right? So if you change your mind, it'll change your body. If you change your body or your practice or your material world, it then goes and changes your mind. And so it has to go in both directions. It also makes me think about brain plasticity, right? That there's so much that we're not doing with our brains. I mean, I can't cite the study, but I've heard that, you know, we only use 10% of our brains as humans. And so if we start activating those kind of neurological circuits, and then, I don't know, creating new neurological pathways with our material world. Like there's so much more that we can do, but it does take practice and kind of that building the mutually reciprocal feedback loops of the mind and the body or the ego and the world or, you know, all those other dualisms.
Yeah. And some of the more like transhumanist folks involved in this are thinking exactly like, how do we change the brain? We can do it with different supplements, you know, psychedelic drugs, bionic implants in our brain. And other people are thinking, well, or it could just be you meditate more on your place and just feel a kinship with the plants and animals and ecosystems around you. So again, there's lots of different ways to be post-human about that, but that is exactly it, is to think about how to reform ourselves.
Yeah, there's those studies that has been done on nuns who pray, and it changes their brain. It changes their spatial orientation or whatever part of the brain connected to spatiality, which is fascinating.
Right. Yeah. And so one of the really important parts about this is how much research has been done on contemplative practitioners in recent years to see the clear physical effects. Like they really are changing their body. And that's when you start to see, wait, contemplative practice is design. You're redesigning your body. And things like being able to pay attention, like your attentional capacities are increased. Emotional resilience is increased. Your amygdala doesn't get triggered as much. You don't go into fight or flight responses as much. Mm. And that really does change the gray matter in your brain. So that when something really triggering happens, you don't go into a fight or flight response. You maintain some kind of equanimity, and that you can bring compassion to the situation and empathy and things like that. So yeah, enhancing capacities for empathy and compassion, being able to pay attention more in difficult situations, having more emotional resilience in difficult situations. It's one of those things, even if you don't believe at all in what these contemplative traditions are telling you about the world, you know, Christianity, Buddhism, whatever, you're like, all I know is it works.
So right.
Even if you don't believe in it, like the studies are in, it changes you. And so that's really, you know, what I'm trying to get into is more the design piece of this. Because of course, this was a piece for the Contemplative Studies unit, and the panel was on posthumanism. So we were all talking about the connection between contemplative and posthuman perspectives. What I was trying to bring in is design.
So when you say design, what I'm hearing from you is redesigning the brain, but are you thinking about design in a different way? Like, do you think that redesigning our cities or our landscapes would kind of redesign the human, or what kind of other dimensions of design were you thinking about including in your paper?
Yeah, precisely because it's post-human design. It's not just about redesigning the human skin in.
Okay.
And it's understanding that the human is always in reciprocal relationship to its environment. And, you know, again, you know, Sloterdijk draws on Heidegger, his idea that to be human is always to be Dasein. To be Dasein is to be being in the world. And so we're always in the world. So to shape us is to shape our world. To shape the world is to shape us. There's right. always this kind of curvature. Whatever you put out into the world curves back upon you. There's always these feedback loops.
Yeah.
And there's been a thing, you know, if you look at design studies, human-centered design has been a big thing where people are like, design shouldn't just be run by computers designing our spaces. Because you can just ask a computer, what's the best way to design an apartment complex? And it'll come up with something that's really efficient in terms of material usage and energy output and stuff like that. But you're like, is it fun for people to live in? Do people feel good there?
Yeah.
So human-centered design is kind of innovative. Post-human design is saying, we got to do better than that. I don't just want human design. I want sustainable design. I want ecological design. Co-design, right? We're designing with one another. So biomimicry is a good example of this.
Right.
What if our design was learning from nature's designs? You know, how can we understand how a dragonfly's wings is so efficient that we can actually use those for some of our own aviation technologies?
Yeah.
Right. Some of the, you know, we make things like cement and concrete when we want to make hard stuff. It turns out mushrooms can make hard stuff just as easily without all of the negative environmental outputs. So what if we started making bricks out of mushrooms? Right. Huh. That's biomimicry. You start to learn what nature does. Nature does a lot of stuff we want to do, but it does it better with a lot less waste, especially. So biomimicry is good. Designs for a circular economy where we think more about having stuff that isn't trashed. We want to design materials that get recycled. You know, we don't want to. And that's the worst case scenario. Ideally, you don't even have to recycle it. You can just reuse it. And if you can't reuse it, you can recycle it. Unfortunately, we have an economy now where there's a lot of stuff that can't even get recycled.
Yeah.
It gets downcycled at best, or it just gets totally trashed at worst. So yeah, this is ways to open up. We're not just designing our brains and our bodies. We're thinking of designing the whole planet. I mean, we're already doing this. This is the Anthropocene. This is the climate crisis. It's mass extinction. We're already designing the planet.
Oh.
We're just doing it in a way that's completely killing life on Earth.
Well, it's almost unintentional. I mean,
yeah.
That's arguable. Okay.
Largely unintentional. People, you know, who are really supporting industrial growth and stuff like that, they're not trying to kill off the human species.
Right. Yeah.
And they don't understand the feedback loops we're caught up in. So, yeah, I think largely it's more ignorance than malice.
Right.
But in any case, there has been a big wave of people kind of pointing this out and saying, there is lots of possibilities for sustainable design, for ecological design. So that's where I'd situate kind of post-human design. And then the question is just bringing contemplative practice into that. Because some of this stuff, like, well, we could redesign materials so they're more sustainable. I'm like, that's great. What if we could also redesign things so they make us feel more at home in the world? Not just sustainable.
Yeah.
But a sense of belonging. And also, of course, a lot of contemplative practices open up onto things like justice or compassion. And so what would it mean to design the world, not just in a way where our materials weren't causing a mass extinction or a climate crisis? What if we were causing more love, more compassion, more justice, more freedom, more peace?
That's a big one.
That's a big one. And so that was my idea in a nutshell, is to bring those three dimensions together and talk about what that kind of design would look like. Like, if we were designing a planet to protect us from exploitation and injustice, if we were designing a planet that would promote universal love and compassion and peace, you know, what would that look like?
Yeah.
And this is, you know, exactly Sloterdijk's work in a lot of regards, not to turn him into some great hero or anything, but I think he's a figure who's still relatively unknown among English speaking people, in contrast to somebody like Bruno Latour or Martin Heidegger, you know, a German predecessor. These are very famous and infamous figures. And Sloterdijk, you know, he's about 75. He's not a young man. And yet, you know, and his works are largely translated into English, but still relatively not well known. So yeah, just trying to kind of introduce people. Like, there's this guy who's kind of pulling together these few dimensions. He understands that we're post-human in a way we've always been post-human. You know, we're always in relationship to a more than human world that's feeding back on us. The human is always in these reciprocal relationships with the spaces it inhabits.
Right.
And that we're always in the design project, that we're always designing ourselves, reforming ourselves, remaking ourselves, remaking the world we're in. And that contemplative practice is key. He's up there with, you know, the French historian of philosophy, Pierre Hadot. Hadot is one of those people who really emphasized philosophy as a way of life. It's not just arguments. It's not just claims that you write on paper and dispute with other people. It's about practices for turning yourself into a certain kind of person, for building character. Right? You build character, you become someone in relationship to others, you build community. And we forget about that sometimes. And it's easy to think that we can do things like ecological design just by virtue of just reading a couple books and using some nice computer software. And we can design like the perfect garden, you know, like permacultural design. You know, if you're like, oh, here's some strategies for making a really nice garden that's very water efficient and, you know, drought resistant or whatever. Like, yeah, but if we add contemplative practice into the mix, that we can not only design a world that's more sustainable, we can design a world that's more compassionate and just. And I think the easiest example of this would be like designing like a Zen rock garden, right? That kind of Zen design, it's not only a space that's not harming its environment, it's also like harmonizing with you to provide a sense of inner peace. And so how do we use contemplative practice as a way to like engage with the natural world around us and redesign ourselves and redesign the world for harmony or for justice, for peace, for love, for compassion? Again, I'm trying to be very painting in broad strokes about this with regard to what posthumanism means, with regard to what ecological design means. But the main idea is to bring those three things together and to see that they're all essentially tied together in the first place. Like, to be human is to be posthuman. We're always ecologically embedded. You know,
just
so we're
being
all,
more intentional about that.
Be more intentional. And that means design. That to be human is to be a design project. And that to be human means you have to engage in practice. There's no human out there that doesn't train in one way or another, whether it's your diet, exercise, sports, learning a musical instrument, learning a language. You know, when you're 3 or 4 years old and you're learning your first language, that's a design project. That's contemplative practice. That's post-human. So these things are all kind of knotted together. And that's it in a nutshell. So really just trying to draw attention to him. I also, you know, was going to mention a little bit about Jenny Odell, Asian-American artist living in Oakland, California, and really famous for her book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy, came out a few years ago. So I'm a big fan of her work. And so she was also going to be part of the paper. Largely it was about introducing people to Sloterdijk, but also her, because she's just another person who's kind of said, look, the future is people being more contemplative, being more ecologically embedded, and being more aware of our capacities to design and redesign ourselves. How design, right, art, architecture, how things like that can really, really save us.
So, yeah, I could see that, because as I'm hearing you, I'm thinking about, once again, the practice of the wild, and you know how there's endless possibilities to the human. I mean, we see that in the fact that just in a short period of time that we've been around and have had control over our environment, you know, we figured out a way to get to the moon. Like, that's, and understand that the Big Bang is an event, and you know, all these amazing possibilities. So I think about like how we apply ourselves, and it just takes a little bit of refocusing, and you know, there's endless possibilities. And so I think a lot about, you know, I'm not that old, but I definitely have old enough to where I've seen rates of depression and anxiety and like mental health being more problematic lately. And I can't help but see it reflected in the way that we're structuring society, and even the way that we build our buildings, that they for the most part are not thinking of our well-being and their design. And that because, you know, businesses run through efficiency, and that's why we're degrading the natural world. But efficiency isn't how the human wants to run. Like, I think that whenever we feel like we're a cog in a machine, that does lead to depression. And then anxiety is because we can't keep up, we can't go fast enough. And, you know, so those are just kind of the things I'm thinking of as I'm hearing you. And then one other thing that I want to bring up is I'm hearing a lot of Thomas Berry and what you're saying. And so my question is, do you think that this is aligned with his notion to, or his call to reinvent the human at the species level?
Oh, no, that's really great. That's a great connection. Thanks. You know, Berry is not somebody who really engaged with design studies at all, because, you know, really during his lifetime, that field was just barely emerging. And related things like media theory and things like that. But yeah, absolutely. I think that's, you know, we could easily translate the idea of reinventing the human and call it redesigning the human. Mm. And it's a little different because design includes more than just the invention process. Design thinking is largely about things like, well, you're going to invent something. After you invent it, you're going to need to test it out with some users. And then the users might be like, this thing is terrible. Or here's some bugs it has. It was great, but it kept shutting down here and there. Or I ran into some obstacles here and there. And then you go, interesting. And you take the feedback from the test, and then you reiterate. Design thinking is so much about iteration. And you invent, you know, which some, there's a handful of pieces that even an invention. Some of that's the ideation. You have to come up with the idea. And then you have to prototype the idea. And then you come up with the invention. You know, like, I'm going to make this. Okay, so you have the idea, then you prototype the idea. Now you have an invention. Now you test the invention with some kind of community of users, talk about the user experience. Based upon the feedback from the user experience, you're going to reiterate. That means going back to the idea phase, going back to the invention phase, the prototyping phase, all that, then test it again with some users. Okay. And so, yeah, and I think in a lot of ways, that's exactly what the field of religion ecology has been doing, you know, for some decades now, is coming up with new ideas and seeing the new ways of life that are part of that, seeing how users are experiencing that, and then kind of going back to the drawing board and seeing how we can reinvent it better. So, yeah, I think that's exactly it. And to always understand that those reinventions are never just humans in a vacuum, that it's always us in relationships to the more than human world.
Right.
And that when you come up with ideas, you can't just use your ego or your rational mind. You have to do contemplative practice to use the fullness of your soul, of your humanity, of your personality, so that we are engaging our intuitive, our imaginal capacities, our moral sensibilities, our aesthetic sensibilities, yeah, our social intelligence, our somatic intelligence. And, you know, the whole kind of idea you get from Catholic social teaching, right? Cura personalis, that we're caring for the whole person here. And so it's, so Berry is a good example of somebody who understands that. If you're going to reinvent the human, you don't just come up with an idea from,
yeah,
from your rational mind. It's going to be from the fullness of your human potential. So yeah, that's very good feedback. And so, yeah, if I work this up in the future, I'll be sure to include Berry Because he was definitely somebody who understood that. For him to say reinvent the human, that's a deep understanding of what it means to be human, that we're an invention project, that there isn't like human nature.
Yeah.
Whatever the nature of humankind is, it's a nature that can reform its own nature. Again, the plasticity of the human brain is a good example. To be human is to be able to form yourself and reform yourself.
Yeah. I think about the current iteration of humans as just habits, like deeply ingrained habits that we formed. And if you think about like Buddhist contemplation and like habits of the mind, it's like the longer that you have like a pattern of thinking, the more it creates like a divot in your mind. And so, you know, that divot is there, but that doesn't mean it's always going to be there. You can kind of work on like changing your mind, right? And so, back to that kind of feedback loop.
Yeah. And that's, you know, I think the most hopeful note to point out is that the destructive presence that humankind currently has on the planet is something that was invented relatively recently.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about the industrial growth society that's emerged over the last few 100 years. Colonialism, capitalism, industrialization, a handful of those things. We're talking a 500-year habit. And if you want to push that back to things that started 2,000 years ago, fine. You want to say it started 10,000 years ago with the Neolithic Revolution, fine. We're a 200,000-year-old species.
Yeah.
So if there's a design flaw that we're dealing with now, it's a very recent flaw. If we're in a divot, you know, if we're in a bit of a rut in our habituation, it's actually a pretty shallow rut. This is something that just happened. And if it happened that recently, we can fix it quickly. Although I had somebody once point out to me when I said that, they're like, something's happened quick, but are not quick to recover from, such as a spinal injury if you fall. And I was like, that's touché.
True. Yeah.
And so
structural injustice is not an easy one to heal from or to even change policies. Yeah.
Species extinction, right? Extinction is
that
forever.
One's not gonna. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, that's why the
don't want to be too optimistic when I say it's a recent problem. We can have a quick fix. Like, of course, there's some things we can't fix and they're already too broken to recover. But the recuperation effort is well on its way. So at the end of the day, I still feel a lot of optimism, perhaps naively. But in any case, I feel that there's a tidal wave of intellectual resources that are supporting this work. You know, Thomas Berry, Jenny O'Dell, Peter Sloterdijk, Bruno Latour. There's just so many people doing it from so many angles. So it gives me a sense of optimism, even in dark times.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. I'm not used to being the host, but it seems like a nice note to end on. I'm not sure how are we doing on time?
Oh, that's good. Yeah, thanks. I think that is a good note to end on. I like to end on a high note, instead of just thinking of the worst thing to say and then ending there. So yeah, I think and that's good. So yeah, thanks for asking about this paper that I was going to deliver. I appreciate that. And thanks for, you know, coming on repeatedly to say what's going on with the field of religion ecology. I know you have a long-term commitment as part of the co-chair for the religion ecology unit at the AAR. So we'll be hearing from you again in the future, I'm sure.
Yep, it's what I do now. It's what I've done for a while. But yeah, co-chair is it's a new level. So.
Right. Thanks a lot. And thanks for prodding me a little to share some of my work. I appreciate it. I hope everybody else did too. If not, I hope you tuned out long ago to avoid the worst of it. And if you stuck around, then you have my thanks, my gratitude. And again, thanks to Kim for playing host or co-host or something.
Oh yeah, I keep calling it co-host, but I ended up being the host, I guess.
Pretty much, yeah. I'm just the one who will eventually click stop on the recording. So
that's up to you.
That's up to me, and I think it's about time. Thanks. Big thanks to Kim, and thanks everybody for tuning in. As always, we'll be back soon with some more conversations for you. So in the meantime, take care and be well.
Bye, everyone.